if you're listening to me, just because somebody is doing nonprofit, please do not assume that they are good people and they are great with children.
Welcome to Popaganda. I'm Shannon Perez-Darby with Tejmika Torak. And this week we have something a little bit different. As we are getting together season two of Popaganda, we wanted to record a little of what are we listening to and what has our attention right now. Season two of Popaganda will be launching in April. While you're waiting, we wanted to give you a little bit of what we're watching, paying attention to in the transformative justice and pop culture world. Where I wanted to start us off is a thing that TikTok brought into my life. Have you been paying attention to or tracking at all, particularly the TikTok and social media conversations about Gypsy Rose?
I have seen a lot of things, mostly on Instagram, sharing Gypsy Rose's first selfie, sharing pictures of her over the holidays, but I have not listened to any of the TikTok dialogue around that. So I'm very curious to see what you've learned and picked up.
I hadn't been paying attention to who Gypsy Rose was, the pop culture conversation around her over the last many years. She did her first TikTok on her account after being released from prison recently. We are recording this in early January, so she has been released within the last couple of weeks as of our recording. She started a TikTok account, so her first TikTok that she posted got like millions and millions of views. So that came up on my account. And that sent me down a rabbit hole where I spent an hour learning about who this was, learning about some of the nuances, and then since then have learned a lot.
Do you miss your mom, Dee Dee?
Yeah, I miss my mom.
When you look back, do you think there are ways that this could have been handled differently?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I look at things in hindsight, and I realized that there were other options besides murder, but I was so sheltered that I couldn't see them at the time.
She's the face of one of the most shocking crime stories in memory.
This is the house where Claudinia Blanchard was found stabbed to death.
Gypsy Rose Blanchard, portrayed by her mother as a chronically ill girl, unable to walk with that signature baby voice.
Right now, I'm in Cinderella's castle.
But it was all a lie.
For folks who are not familiar, Gypsy Rose, her mom had Munchausen by proxy. And so growing up, her mom was a nurse of folks who have Munchausen by proxy, was particularly effective at using her knowledge about health to abuse and manipulate her daughter. Her mother had convinced people that Gypsy Rose was very sick with a number of different cancers, rare diseases, and had done a lot of crowdsourcing, had seen many, many doctors, had many, many appointments, and basically had Gypsy Rose housebound. She forced her to use a wheelchair, even though Gypsy Rose didn't need the wheelchair, but her mother insisted she use it whenever she was out in the world. Gypsy Rose did not know she was not sick. And so she didn't understand that she wasn't dying of cancer. Leukemia was the primary thing that was centered on. And her mother was very effective, had many doctors convinced of these diagnoses. And so Gypsy Rose was very isolated, didn't have a lot of friends, didn't have a lot of social networks. She meets this guy, Nicholas Godejohn, online. They start an online relationship. And the shortest version of that is that she mentions to him, you know, I need to escape this. I can't live like this anymore. It's unclear exactly what the nuance of that conversation is. I think there's some dispute about it. But the result of that conversation, Nick agrees to kill her mother and says, I can take care of her for you. I can kill her. So they make a plan that does end up being what happened. So Nick kills Gypsy Rose's mother. And then they go on the run. Both of them were pretty unskilled and unsupported. Then there's a pretty public trial that happens. So there's not an accessory to murder charge in that state, I have learned in going down this rabbit hole.
Oh, interesting.
She gets a series of charges that are about sort of participating and knowing about the murder and not intervening. She did not do the act of killing her mother, but she knew about it. So she gets a 10-year sentence and Nick gets a life sentence. There had been a series of documentaries, and then what's probably most well known is the show The Act on Hulu. Gypsy Rose has been just doing massive amounts of press of podcasts. She was on The View. I saw this clip of her on The View, which is the strangest, most awkward, fascinating piece.
You are not alone in this, you know, situation. There are other ways out. I did it the wrong way.
Don't say that.
I did something wrong, and I paid my dues for it.
Oh, you mean that part?
Yes, the part of it. Oh, yeah. You know that part of it.
Yeah. Where are you going with this?
No. You know, so I did something.
Murder is wrong.
Yes, murder is wrong.
And so the things to me that are really interesting about her story, you know, she was in her early 20s when she went to prison. She's in her 30s now. And a third of her life has been incarcerated. And so much of what she's talking about, her daily reality, is the reality of being in prison. So she's just talking a lot about her friends from prison, about what the culture of prison was like, about her experience there, about navigating that. And so really talking and to me, it actually seems like a very grounded way about her experience of incarceration when people are trying to get these sort of salacious pieces around how she was abused as a child and around the murder. And honestly, it feels like it's having this side effect of really educating a certain kind of population about incarceration. Some of the interesting things about her experience is that she has two parole officers. So she has two separate parole officers for whatever way the charges went. Couldn't find more details about exactly what were the circumstances. She did an interview on the Vial Files. So it's the podcast with Nick Vial, who's famous from The Bachelor. And he had the first podcast interview with her after she was released. So they do a long form interview. And she was talking about how she actually has two parole officers. She had the situation where she was going to an event in another state. She had gotten permission from what was sort of her primary parole officer to leave the state. She went, and then her secondary parole officer called and said, well, I didn't give you permission. You need it from both of us. And then she was required to come back to her state because she needed permission from both parole officers.
You know, we were supposed to be in Kansas City for the first weekend she was out, and then plans changed. So
yeah, what happened there, Gypsy?
So my parole officer, I have two. So my parole officer in Louisiana said, yeah, you're good to go to the game. I don't mind you spending a few days in Kansas City. I'm good with that. I won't meet with you until after the holidays. So the day after I get out and we're having this gathering with my parents and my family and my friends,
we
and all
just
this,
got done shopping
we
for just, shoes.
Yeah.
Like the
we went to the shoe store.
So people are following us.
Yes,
at this
yes.
Time.
Yeah. We were hounded by paparazzi. But I got a call and it was my Missouri parole officer saying, so are you on your way back to Louisiana? And I'm like, no, I'm like, we're going to stay a few days in Kansas City.
I was very skeptical because like I said, we were being hounded by media, like people were following mm-hmm. us, and a strange number calls my phone because I was the connection.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I kind of questioned the parole officer at first. I was like, how do we know? Because he answers the phone mm-hmm. and he says, I'm so-and-so. I need to know where you're going and where you're at. And I was kind of like, no, you're not getting that information. No, we got people following us. I'm not telling you where we're going.
Right.
And Gypsy finally had to like calm me down because mm-hmm. I raised it up. And then she's like, stop, it might actually be him.
Yeah, it
and
might
I was
actually
like,
be him.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then I let her take over. And then come to find out, it was her Missouri pro officer telling her she had to leave like right then.
Yeah, because he didn't give me permission. The Louisiana one did, but the Missouri one didn't.
Interesting.
And so the Missouri one overruled the Louisiana one.
Wow. And
so really talking about this piece that I think a lot of folks don't know. So people can be familiar with prisons and with jails and that part of incarceration. But I think this part around court monitoring and how you could be released from prison and still have the criminal legal system monitoring you, controlling your behavior, sometimes for lifetimes. So there are certain kinds of charges where you are forever on parole. There's not really a non-monitoring time. She's on parole for 3 years, but the fact that she has multiple parole officers, she has to approve things through. My best understanding is I think she has charges in different states. And so each state has a parole officer for her, but don't quote me on that. I couldn't get more details around exactly what was happening. Honestly, the more I listen to her, the more grounded it is that she was a person who was ritualistically abused for basically her entire childhood. She was trying to find a way out of that, and that this series of events happened. A lot of her activism now is about talking to children who are experiencing violence and abuse and manipulation from parents about what the path out and that that path she took was not the way, and just really grounding in, it was so clear how little agency she had and just how isolated she was. And now that she's out of prison, she's married to, you know, he seems normal. Her husband, Ryan Scott Anderson, he's been doing a lot of press with her. They met while she was incarcerated, and he proposed to her while she was incarcerated. And now that she's out, he's with her. They're living together. They're married. And despite all odds, it seems pretty solid over there. I know that seems unlikely. I know it seems unlikely.
Watch the act. So, you know, I did have a little bit of the background from that documentary. My response to her new relationship isn't that I'm doubting necessarily the quality of a relationship, because that's not my place. I feel complicated emotions about her not having an opportunity to start an intimate relationship with someone outside of being under some form of imprisonment, right? Like, even in her childhood, having her first intimate personal relationship with a partner be under those conditions that ended in such a horrific way, and then to have found a solid person. Again, not questioning necessarily that he's solid and that their relationship is solid. The context within which we find ourselves in relationship matters. And I'm curious about what it feels like for her as she's now more free, not free, clearly, because there's all of this court monitoring and surveillance. So it's still not free, and also has more freedom of movement, like what relationship will feel like as she starts to expand as a person. But, you know, not all relationships are necessarily forever anyway. So I'm just hopeful that she feels a sense of freedom and autonomy in her relationships. So I didn't get that from the movie. It was what, like a miniseries based on a true story,
which she didn't participate in. So one of the things she's talked about now is that she didn't have the opportunity. They didn't speak with her at all. And that she actually feels pretty impacted by that because it became so popular and her story really blew up from the act. And then she was still incarcerated while it happened. So many of the folks she was incarcerated with or the staff at the prison didn't really know her story. And then when that happened, she started having really different experiences. So people started looking at her differently. The staff started interacting with her differently. And then she had a couple of situations where, because it became so popular, someone, just a random person in the world, started telling the media that she was going to go break Gypsy Rose out of prison. And so then it just didn't involve her. She'd never met that person. But then she ended up getting put in solitary confinement for 2 weeks while they investigated. So she had pretty high consequence from the act. Now that she's out and she's writing a memoir that she's been releasing pieces of, has been saying how negative the experience of the act was for her. She just didn't have a say in it. It was them embellishing a story they knew publicly without any information from her.
It goes back to our conversation about true crime and like the difference between ethical journalism and storytelling and the sort of exploitative model that Netflix, Hulu, these streaming platforms will create original content that's loosely based on a true story. And it is harmful. I'm so glad to know that, because as I'm squaring like your retelling of the story against the act, and I'm like, huh. There wasn't really a mention of how her mother had those skills and how she was using them. They gave you more of this vibe, like she was coming into an appointment with like this large three-ring binder. It didn't feel particularly skillful. It felt more like obfuscation, like she was just really tricky. And so she would just go from doctor to doctor. And that obviously narrows the story. And it also narrows the way that we see people who do harm, is that sometimes we think they're just big dum-dums who are doing these harmful things that we're not necessarily perceiving as like a skill that has been built and used in a way that's harmful, versus like someone who's like, whoops, I just encountered a harmful thing that I got to do. And I'm like, no, there are people who do harm that use the skills they've built professionally and develop skills of hiding and lying and all these things and manipulation over time. And so for them to tell this story in a way that's like, look at this backwards, Like, she's dresses really frumpy. She's overweight. Like, she seems really insecure, which to me tracks as like someone who would be doing these kinds of things would have a high level of insecurity. But they don't show her as particularly smart or skillful. And actually, the neighbors around her in the act, again, not the true story, sort of also respond to her that way as like kind of a weirdo, kind of someone who is on the outsides of community. And so that's really interesting. I look forward to hearing more story directly from Gypsy Rose, not from the place of like, I need to know the details of her trauma, but just to square the story. If someone's going to tell your story and you have the opportunity to write the record, I want that for you because it does matter. And people do respond to you differently based on what they've heard, especially as someone re-entering public life outside of incarceration. She deserves to have some sort of accurate as possible perception about what happened in her life and the abuse that she experienced.
And it does sound like she was able to be part of some programming while incarcerated that supported her to build some skill. She talked about it only high level in the interview that I heard. It's very common that outside organizations partner with prisons and then come and do content. And so it sounds like there was an organization like that that came in and did skill building, relationship work, maybe even healing work. And it became very clear she built a lot of support and skill from whatever sets of supports she had while incarcerated, because how she's talking about relationship stuff, how she's talking about how people should treat each other, how she's talking about her own survivorship. In the interview, I heard talking about being a survivor of childhood sexual abuse in really grounded ways and how its impact on her. She had experienced sexual violence from Nick, the man who killed her mother. And she is clearly speaking as a person who's had support to do some work on that. I had to assume in the isolation that she had and the abuse she experienced by her mother, how she is speaking now is definitely someone who has built a fair amount of skill.
I just recently watched was The Curious Case of Natalia Grace. I don't know if you've had one of those shows that pops up as your recommendations. And I was like, yeah, watched it was because it says Natalia speaks. So as we just mentioned, there's not always a lot of first person retelling, especially in TV pop culture. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. Let me see what this is. And then I'm watching the preview and it's this family that adopted a child from Ukraine.
Oh, I do know about this story. I didn't watch that particular piece, but from TikTok, I know about the story. Yeah.
If you don't want a spoiler, you're going to need to fast forward. But the way that they created this show, I have lots of discomfort. Even though Natalia is clearly a part of what's happening, it does a great job in some ways of taking you through what people thought at the time. They're like, wait, is she a child or is she a 30-year-old impersonating a child because she has this genetic disability, the name of which I'm not remembering. And then they're like, wait, is she attacking the children in the house? And which is a story that we hear from people who are foster parents who do abuse their children will say things like, I was protecting my other children. But so there's like all of these things. It includes foster care. It includes disability. It includes child abuse. It includes domestic violence. I shared it with my patrons and I was like, TW, everything. Everything is in this. But the reason I bring it up around talking about Gypsy Rose is because children with disabilities are 6 times more likely to experience child sexual abuse. And that's just what we understand. One of the things that the Barnetts did, this family that adopted Natalia, they had her age legally changed because they wanted to be able to remove her from their home. And so as a child, she is left in 2 different apartments, one that is an apartment complex and one that is a house, a standalone house that she's renting. Both spaces incredibly inaccessible, where she is left to fend for herself as an adult. She is also framed essentially by the Barnetts as a dangerous person who's a trickster, a liar, a manipulator. And they tell everyone around her this story. And everyone just takes it as that must be the truth. These beautiful foster parents, Kristen and Michael Barnett, go to Ukraine. They decide they're going to adopt a child. This is not the first child they've attempted to adopt, but this is one that came to them that was like, you have 24 hours to make this decision. Technically, I don't think it was an international adoption because I think Natalia had already been adopted into another American family that was taking Natalia to these dwarfism conference spaces and basically being like, hey, you don't have a child. Wouldn't you like a child who's like you? And this whole rehoming situation that happens in our adoption culture is what was happening with Natalia. And so she's literally being shopped out. There's like two families that are interviewed in this documentary that are like, yeah, we had her at our house. We were exploring the option of adopting her, but we chose not to, which is so disturbing. And I know it's hard. It's hard to talk about adoption because it's like, yes, do I want children to have a good home? Absolutely. Do I understand that adopting a child is a significant transition in your life that should be done thoughtfully? Yes. But does that mean that we bring human children with all the complexity into our homes like puppies and we give it a try? I don't feel good about that. I don't feel good about what that must have felt like for her, especially as a person with a physical disability that already cuts her off from community in a lot of different ways. As she gets adopted by Kristen and Michael, this is not a family that has the same experience. So their house is not necessarily set up for a child with this disability. Now, Christine Barnett has a childcare situation where she serves children with disabilities. If you're listening to me, just because somebody is doing nonprofit, please do not assume that they are good people and they are great with children. Because the way that people were like, let this woman just fucking do whatever she wanted, because they were just like, well, of course, like she's willing to work with these poor disabled children. Like, so gross, so gross. So anyway, at some point, Christine starts spinning this tale that Natalia is an adult because she does not want to care for her anymore, is what the assumption is. And based on the evidence that's told throughout this whole story, she's doing the research of how long she has to be responsible for this child and comes up with this strategy that she's an adult so she can live on her own. What I gathered is that if your child has a significant disability that requires care, you as a parent are responsible for that child, probably for the rest of their life, which means they were like, oh crap, we're gonna have to pay for her surgeries. We have to provide for her care. And they didn't wanna do that. And so the state was enforcing, no, this is your child. You have to care for this child that you adopted. So then Christine's like, oh, sorry, my other child who is a genius, he also is autistic. And she was basing this whole idea of adopting Natalia on the premise that she had created a genius. It was her parenting that created this child as a genius. Obviously, I mean, I could say the same thing, but y'all haven't met my kids, so you'd never know. But yeah, she was like, I'm going to make this kid a genius. And Natalia is like just a normal kid, probably genius in lots of ways that did not register, right? But not at the level of her son, who has this comprehensive, like amazing ability to do mathematics. She decides that she's going to take her son to go to college in Canada to this special program because he's a genius. And makes her husband stay back in the US because ultimately he would be responsible if anything happened to Natalia. Like, so devious, so devious. But the whole reason I'm even telling this whole story is that there is this moment where Natalia is able to go and talk to Michael.
Why are we here, Michael?
Why are we here? That's well, if you're talking philosophically.
No, like, I want to know, why did you adopt me in the first place?
Why?
Many of these questions, there's not going to be a single answer to. Look, I've learned recently you and I had the same monster.
Christine.
And we are here because we both were incredible victims of an otherworldly type of abuse.
Okay, first, I'm gonna say please don't cuss.
I'll do my best. I speak in a certain way. I'll do my best.
Second, what do you mean by you were a victim?
Oh, God. This is all the stuff you don't know.
Well, you want to elaborate?
Yeah, I do. You want to give me time to do it? This is not easy. I had the same monster you did. I was exceptionally controlled and put down and threatened, was minimalized. Anything that was who I was ripped from me, and I was guided and instructed to be exactly what she wanted me to be.
What do you mean by threatened?
Her favorite threat was taking the boys away from me and making sure I would never see them ever again.
Why didn't you leave?
That's the best question ever. I tried. And this is, these answers aren't going to be what you're looking for to a degree, but I tried to leave her no less than 10 times. I ended up in the hospital regularly over it.
Why did you marry her?
That's a hell of a question.
There's two seasons. So the first season is just walking us through everything that happened. So the whole time you're like, wait, is this person an adult? Wait, is this person attacking the children? Are these parents having domestic violence issues? Like, they really put you in real time in the first season. And the second season, I was really excited about and really was like, oh, I can't wait to talk to Shannon about this, because there are all these moments of opportunity for repair. She moves in with a family that is providing her with a lot of love and care upon her telling. And she meets with Michael and is like, why didn't you just give me back? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? Did you know about this? Did you know about that? And Michael Barnett is a really hard person for me to watch as someone who's being interviewed. He is clearly very dishonest and is still clearly hiding a lot and has a very dramatic affectation that's really hard for me. He's the victim in every story, you can tell. Like, in anything that's happening, he's definitely the victim. He tells her that he was being abused by the same person and tries to equate their experiences.
Oh, interesting. With him as the sort of agency of an adult in a partnership and her as a child, an immigrant child with a disability who was adopted into this home without the agency you have when you are a child who's being adopted.
Correct. At the time that this is happening too, not only all of that, yes, but she was like 7 or 8. We're not talking about a teenager that was dropped off. We're talking about legit a child. I had a real hard time watching him, but it was so powerful to watch her ask him those questions. And she went to a neighbor and said, you know, I was best friends with your daughter and Christine came over and told you a few things about me. And then you just cut me off. Why did you believe her? Why did you never check on me? What made me look so terrible? You know, like, she's really getting into the hard-hitting questions, you know? It was a hard thing to watch, but I don't know that I've seen documentaries like that where people come together in the spirit of, for some part, it was repair. I think she wanted more closure with Michael and more like accountability, just to be able to name the things that were harmful. She does say that she forgives him, but I don't think it was about repair, like, we're going to go back together and this is going to be some kind of relationship. But with the neighbor, I got the sense where she was like, you abandoned me. You abandoned me and I loved your family. And that felt more like a repair conversation or the possibility of repair. But then they end season two with like a twist that I'm not going to talk about. Number one, because I'm a little upset about it. But number two, because y'all need to see it. But it's important to have the person who experienced the violence be the person who gets to tell their story. And you could see the difference in this telling, even though there are parts of it that feel very sensationalized and other accounts that are not shared from the perspective of the person who was experiencing it. And the whole time they're still talking about how Natalia could be totally lying. Like, it's just, so it's a lot.
The last thing I was hoping to talk about of what have I been watching that I can't stop thinking about is The Garden, Commune or Cult. Have you watched this or heard about it? Did you watch it?
Well, I heard about it from you. Yes. And of course, I take my pop culture homework very seriously.
I appreciate that. I have been thinking about this show so much since I watched it. The premise of the show is that you have this off-grid community called The Garden.
Oh my God. I want to talk about this so bad.
The Garden was originally founded in 2009. While they don't have formal leaders, a big influence into the founding of The Garden is Patrick Martian. He purchased the original land that the commune was on. He has this really fascinating life story in that he grew up in the Rainbow Family Collective. And so they're best known for rainbow gatherings, being hippie, post-hippie. The rainbow gatherings started in the 1970s with some of these shared values of peace and love and living off the land. And so he had grown up in a commune and then seeds this new commune. I don't think they use the word seeding, but I'm going to use the word seeding. And so this commune, The Garden, blows up in 2021 on TikTok through originally two of its members who are in a relationship with each other, Julie and Tree. We're going to talk about Tree in a minute because I have a lot of feelings about Tree, but
I'm going to try really hard to not make this whole thing about Tree. We might have to have a whole separate conversation about Tree.
Absolutely. Julia and Tree are social media savvy. They're young. They each have their own individual TikToks. And so they start presenting about the lifestyle, how to live off the land, how to make your own composting toilet. And then the big thing that happens that blows up is one of the members of The Garden, a white lady with dreads, I will say. I was telling my partner that I was like, all right, I'm going to do my white lady with dreads thing, which I'm just like, is 2024. And if you are a white person who has dreads, you either don't care. You either are explicitly just don't care that you're doing an appropriative racist thing, or you are so isolated and have no relationships with any people of color, with any of black folks to be like, What the fuck are you doing? The feeling inside me I have about white people with dreads is so strong.
Just in case, TLDR, stop it. Like, knock it off. Stop it. Like, can you please just, it's enough already. We've had it.
It just is like to know that you are doing something where you walk around and are alienating yourself at the very least, like doing something harmful, but also just that you don't care about being in relationship with black folks or any folks of color. And also like white people, your hair does not dread naturally. So you're just doing a thing. You have to do it on purpose. You're not just going to accidentally oopsies white person yourself into white dreads, no matter what people with white dreads will tell you is their experience. All right. End rant about white people with white dreads. So she is this woman. I actually don't even know her name. I didn't get that far. And I don't know if it's necessary, but white woman with dreads. There is a clip on TikTok of someone asking her about her white lady dreads. And she basically says that she doesn't see race or color or gender, and that she actually thinks it's racist to accuse her of white supremacy.
So sometimes people, when I mention that I don't see races, I don't see gender, some people tell me that that is a white privileged thing for me to say. And I think telling somebody that they're white privileged is a racist thing to say, because you're calling me a color that I don't define myself with.
Well, and there you have your answer. You were wondering, it confirms. She don't care.
There you have your answer. Yeah. She doesn't care. It's not that she doesn't know. She doesn't care. So a big thing blows up, which is, I'm so sorry to laugh. She kills a cat on the land, eats it, and then, I'm so sorry, I can't do it without laughing, eats it and then makes a hat out of the hide. As you can imagine, TikTok loses their fucking minds.
Oh, I don't know if you've heard of pets. Have you ever heard of pets? Yeah, right. Think about yourself.
You know, allegedly. It sounds like the cat was dead and there was definitely a hat made out of the cat. There's some dispute about whether the cat was killed, whether it died. It sounds like they did eat it. they have this moment of that blowing up. There was some story that the cat was killing all the chickens. And so they were like, hey, you can't have a cat here. It wasn't anyone's pet. It was sort of just a cat on the land. I don't actually care for the purposes. Like, I don't need to know the truth of what happened with the cat. And so they blow up because of that moment. Then there is this, I think it's originally a Discovery Channel that then is airing on HBO Max. They create a reality television show functionally out of this commune. And so they build the premise of the show. It is a collective. It's collectively run by consensus. They do a consensus style that is sort of consensus through lack of objection. If you are part of the commune, you get a vote. All decisions are made collectively by consensus. You're in discussion. If you don't object, they have 10 minutes of silence where anyone can speak up and say, I don't agree with this. And it only takes one person to block a vote. And so that's how they make all their big decisions. So the premise of the show is that then people have now found out from TikTok and are curious about the commune. So they make this rule that people can come for 10 days. Anyone can come, mostly folks off of TikTok. And then if you'd like to stay after 10 days, you can ask to stay. And then the collective has to vote you in. And so everyone has to agree. If you are voted in, then you're a voting member of the commune. And so then they invite people on in this sort of reality television show. Some people are more serious. Some people are definitely just sort of reality television people. And that's the premise of the show. Tejmika, tell me your thoughts about the garden.
Oh, let me start by saying that Tree was like every self-important, entitled man-child I have ever encountered in my life. And the way that folks catered to him, there were so many moments when I was just like, oh, he's developed a lot of skill. He is clearly very smart. He is clearly very good at the things that make a commune happen. He is very, very limited in his emotional maturity and his ability to navigate conflict and his ability to have a fair-minded conversation.
To be accountable for anything, his ability to say like, oh, I am responsible for anything. He just can't be responsible for anything.
No, not a single thing. And it felt like watching a grown man cycle in and out of temper tantrum. That was one of my number one takeaways. One of the things I feel most challenged by, and I think I've talked about this before, is organizing with cis men because they do this shit. And then enter, there are two other men that come.
Tyler Milligan is the ex-military prepper.
Oh, right. So there's Tyler Milligan. There's a really interesting thing about mental health that's happening in this commune and the way that they talk about it and the way that they interact with what is working for them as individual people. Because Tyler is very open about some of his mental health challenges, which I appreciated that he was so aware and thoughtful. And because of the way his brain works, he's like, this is how I need to live in order to be the best version of myself. I have to be on a schedule. Like, I'm regimented because if I don't, things go awry. And as someone who has ADHD that fights every day of her life to not have a schedule but needs one desperately, I totally get it. And also his conversation around violence made me really uncomfortable. And he came to this, you know, of course, this is also something that I witness a lot. He's ex-military. And so there's this way that military people do things that gets transplanted into these sort of social justice spaces. I'm like, no. Military is actually the opposite of social justice. So if the military is doing it, I'm going to give a strong recommendation that we just take that thing and put it right in the trash and figure out something else so that we can do it differently. And he was definitely that guy, but also he was accountable. He was responsible. He's deeply in love with his best friend. And they had it felt like a high level of intimacy.
Yeah, I mean, Tyler is very clear. He actually wants to be a cult leader.
Yeah.
I reject the loose premise of the show, which is like commune or cult. I think it's just they're trying to capitalize on a moment where cults are a thing we're talking about a lot.
You're right.
Spoiler. But towards the end, he basically is like, no, I want to run this, but I want to be solely in charge. Me and Heather, his wife, he's like, we're going to be solely in charge. Basically says he's trying to run a cult and he wants a thing where he has soul. He doesn't want like collective decision making. He just wants to be the only one in charge on his own land. I'm like, oh, friend, that is a cult. I don't actually think they have a cult there, but he's like a baby cult leader. He'd like love to be a cult leader. He's trying to do that.
Oh God. Can you imagine that level of responsibility? No, thanks. My child, Levi, said one time, he's 15 now. I feel like he said this maybe like 4 or 5 years ago. I said, are you ready to take over the world? Like, we were on the way to school or something. And he was like, I do not want to be in charge of this world. It is too much work. I was like, yes, exactly. I don't want to be in Tyler's commune. And I don't want to be in Tree's commune, but I feel like they're somewhere in the middle where Tyler is taking a lot of responsibility and showing up and skill building. And he genuinely, you know, he wants to run a cult. So that's not great. We give a little minus on the scoreboard for him for that. But he does genuinely want to care for the people within his community. And you can feel that from him. But it's not going to be great. And then there's Tree, who's like, I'm not responsible for anything. I can do whatever I want. I make any choice and everybody's just supposed to fall in line. And then there was the other guy, the other Tyler.
Tyler C. Tyler Covington.
That was a journey.
That was a journey.
I experienced a lot with the situation with Tyler. Again, it goes back to this idea. There just really are white men in this world who just really think that they can really do everything. Like their masculinity is just going to carry them over. This guy is like, yeah, I haven't been hiking in 1,000 years. I've gained a lot of weight. I'm not as healthy as I used to be. Not that weight equals health.
I mean, watching him drag his roller bag up a dirt road where I'm just like, they don't have electricity. You've never set up a tent before. You're unprepared to do this task. But he thinks he's going to kill it. He thinks he's going to be like rocking it.
Yeah, I feel like the amount of confidence that he walked into this situation with was very undue, very unearned. But all of it together seemed very much like what it would be like to try to create a commune from scratch. And then to just randomly let people show up. So if you randomly let people show up without any sense of who they are, what their goals are, what their motivations are.
Shared values that in order to join, you'd have to be able to agree that collective decision-making was something you were interested in. I mean, that's the thing is like they have Tyler M join and he is really explicit. He's not interested in collective decision-making, which is one of the only shared premises they have is that they're going to do consensus style decision-making. And he's not interested in that. And so now you've brought somebody in who's not interested in one of your base premises.
And you voted him in. Like you are the one who chose that he can stay.
And you voted him in.
As someone who spends a lot of time with other people trying to do things all together, I think there is maybe a gross misunderstanding of how much work is involved on the front end when we're talking about shared values and belonging and who is going to do what and what way and how. That, to me, has become so central to my work that one of my favorite questions is what's going to happen when we disagree?
Yep, exactly.
Because I'm like, everything else is probably going to be fine. I just need to know how are we going to handle conflict? Because that will tell me a lot about who we are going to be together. They were just like, everybody come. And I'm like, yeah, have you ever had a house party? That shit gets fucked up real fast because everybody comes.
I mean, this is what's so interesting to me about the show is exactly all the things you're saying about how do humans come together and make decisions. In my transformative justice vision, I'm envisioning pretty radically different ways of being in relationship. And I get very interested in how are we going to get there? And so watching folks who I do think the people who started the commune, I believe have a genuine interest in trying to think about how to relate to each other in a different way. I believe there was some meaningful interest for many people in that task. And I think what this shows is how freaking hard it is to do that. And if you're unprepared, unskilled, even just unaware how hard it is and how much we rely on social conventions, how much we rely on sort of these structural scripts that have built into them racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, rape culture, and then to reinvent those, which means every little thing you have to renegotiate. And it's exhausting and it takes time and energy and resource. And so watching people try to do that is what I think is the fascinating part actually about this show.
I agree. And I agree with you too, that it's interesting the framing around cult. I disagree as well. I do not feel like this is a cult situation. I do feel like these are folks who are trying really hard to do something that is incredibly difficult without the skill set it takes to manage conflict. Part of the reason I feel like the consensus model, I mean, it certainly wouldn't be something I would put in my commune, when you are creating a commune, collective or whatever that is disconnected from those sort of social supports that we rest on, we don't have time. We don't have time to negotiate. There's this moment where Tyler wants to teach them how to hunt small animals like squirrels, rabbits, set up traps and things like that. And he's like, I think it would really help our diet. Now, for those of you who don't know, they mostly dumpster dive. That's how they're getting a lot of their food. And he was like, there's a way for us to supplement our diet. We can do this ourselves. And it's important that we have these skills. And I was like, I was watching his presentation. And I was like, that sounds totally reasonable. Tyler, thank you so much.
I would be interested in learning how to hunt small game from Tyler.
Yeah. And especially if you're living on the land. And I know a lot of folks who, I don't know them personally, but I understand that prepping has to do with self-sufficiency in the event that the system that we need collapses, right? And so like, yeah, knowing how to hunt on your land, even if it's small game like squirrels and rabbits, that's a skill that is not going to be a bad thing in that situation. But one person in the collective was like, no, I don't feel good about that. I still think it's inhumane to kill animals. He had a very specific reason. I can't remember what it was, but I was on Tyler's side. I was like, oh, one person. If you are hungry and the person standing between you and your ability to feed yourself and the people around you is one person, we don't have time for that. I was like, okay, we're taking a vote. This guy, he's out of the group, right? Which is probably not how we do TJ, but I was thinking, I'm hungry. We got to get him out of here so I can eat. You know, we have been exploring lots of models at Firecracker. We just rewrote all of our bylaws because we did the thing that a lot of nonprofits do. And by we, I mean me, because at the time I was the only one there, you know, where you copy and paste a document. And you're like, this, you do a little zhuzhing to it. And you're like, this is my bylaws, state of Michigan, enjoy. No one will ever refer to these again. So we rewrote them. And one of the things we were talking about is how do we make decisions? And so we decided to start using a consent-based model, which is essentially that the person with the best information that is the closest to the problem or the people is the person or people who guide us towards an answer. And it has more to do with acceptable risk than it does knowing for sure that the answer that you're giving, the yes, the no, the maybe, is the right one. And so that's sort of where we're leaning right now, because most bylaws, most organizations are run by what? Robert's Rules of Order.
I'm having like a reaction from you just saying it. I'm like, oh God, are they like British based?
No, they're military based. They are military based.
Naturally.
If you look up Robert's Rules of Rule of Order and where it comes from, it is based in the military and the hierarchical structure of who gets to make a decision and majority rule. And so we were like, oh, that's military? We don't do military things here. There's lots of ways to make decisions. That one though,
In 12-step models, particularly in Al-Anon, which I'm most familiar with, there used to be Robert's Rules of Order, used to be some of the decision-making in the group consensus process. And a lot of Al-Anon is moving towards this knowledge-based decision-making model, which essentially is there are people with particular information about different things. And so those people should have a particular say. Doesn't mean they're the only deciders, but if you're like, hey, this person is responsible for the website, so we're making a decision about a website, let's listen to them first and lean heavily on their advice because they have knowledge about that area. And then if you're talking about the finances, great, this person looks at the finances every day. They have the knowledge. They are persons with particular expertise. Let's lean heavily in. And then we still make the decision together, but we prioritize people who have particular knowledge in the area that we are deciding. That sounds great to me. There's a lot of things I don't know about. And so I don't need to be the primary person or have the same weight of say about things that I don't know anything about.
Yeah. And this goes back to the work you do on the front end too, because if you don't trust the person that's making the decision and it is their job to make the decision, then that person should not be in that role. You've already made a mistake. And I know that from experience, because why am I doing this work? Oh, I'm doing this because I can't trust the person who's supposed to be doing it. It's time for a direct conversation, right? About like what is happening and how do we practice accountability and show up for the thing that we committed to do. That tells me a story about what's happening in that relationship, that you can't trust the person you hired or the person you're working with to do the thing that they are supposed to be doing, you know?
And that is one of the principles in Al-Anon, which is participation is the key to harmony.
Oh.
So, which is just like, hey, did you not do the thing? Are you just coming in at the end? Part of decision-making is that you got your butt busy doing the work and so that you know about it because you've been involved. And so if you're just on the sidelines and then you're trying to jump in and be a big decision maker, participation is the key to harmony. Get up and get involved, or just shush, shush. You don't need to have an opinion about something if you weren't doing the labor and work of being involved in it.
Yeah, it's okay to say I didn't read the meeting notes.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
I didn't have time to read the meeting notes. I don't have an opinion. I'm happy to chime in next week if I have time. Yeah. There's a lot of posturing culturally that we have to know the answer all the time. And I really like models that say, no, actually, the reason you don't know, Tajmika and Shannon, is because you were watching TV.
Which means I know about the garden, but maybe not about whatever other thing that was happening.
That's right. If we happen to need someone to help us decide about a TV problem,
exactly,
we're going to go ahead and call y'all. But like this other thing, and I'm like, yes, please release me from the responsibility of being a person who can do all things and know all things. None of us are that person. And the amount of stress and strain that folks in leadership feel because the expectation is that they can answer all the questions and can do all the things is why we have a culture where people can't be in leadership for very long, because you're going to fail. You're going to make a mistake. Or we have leaders who are unaccountable because everybody else is doing the work and they're just existing in a leadership role. And it's like, no, I want to participate in ways that match my integrity. I want to be honest about what I know and what I don't know. And let me be clear. I don't work in an institution. And so this is hearsay, but I watch people who don't get to be vulnerable in their places of work as leaders. They don't get to admit that they don't know how to do something because there are consequences, there are politics, there's all these things that are happening within an institution, and those things don't serve the work.
Yeah. As we're wrapping up, the last thing that I wanted to talk about related to the garden was just mostly like a gush fest about my love of Tashayla.
Yeah, I have a lot of love for her. As someone who just recently went back to the shooting range so I can get my CPL and exploring those skills, and the fact that she was like, I gotta go.
So for folks who don't know, so she is a Black woman. It starts off with her, I think, actually shooting a machine gun at a shooting range. Mm-hmm. You know, she's very gun savvy. Talking to her community, she's polyamorous, like orienting to her life and her community. She's interested in the land. And I will say just the racial dynamics at the garden is that there are definitely a lot of white people who are in front of the camera, but it is not all white folks. There are a notable, but maybe not majority, people of color. And so she goes, I find her to be really grounded, probably the most relatable person on the show, where I'm like, oh, I could recognize you. And then basically, people start getting a little wacky and she just packs everything up in the night and just heads out. She's like, nope, I'm heading out. And she's like, no, I'm not fucking around. Like, bye. She doesn't say goodbye to anyone. She just like, she basically like leaves in the middle of the night and is just like, nope.
Yeah, she did an Irish goodbye. That's what my understanding is. You just leave. You don't tell anybody nothing. I also found her a lot more relatable. I find people who are preppers in a way that isn't disconnected from our current reality, or people who are preppers that understand that the thing that you are most likely prepping for is like the thing that's not maybe going to happen. You know, there's this other TV show that is like a prepper competition. I can't remember the name of it. Listen, I don't know why I fell down this rabbit hole either. We're not going to get into why I find myself in these spaces, but it's a competition. So there'll be a person who's like, I think that the world is going to end in this particular way, or a person or a group. And then they show how they've prepped. And then these prepping experts give them a score at the end of the show, which I think is really fun. It'll be like, based on our panel of experts, these folks could live for 18 months.
I watched that show. Now that you're saying that, I'm like, this is coming back to me. This is coming back to me. It took me a second, but it's the scoring of like, yeah, you could last this long.
Of course you did. And they're always like a little salty. They're like, I could definitely live for 5 years because of blah, blah, blah. And they're like, well, the thing that I thought was so fascinating about this show was just how every person that was prepping had a different idea of what they were prepping for. And so their solutions were very specific to that particular kind of thing. And so I don't find that relatable. There are people who talk about prepping in a more realistic, like, you don't know what's going to happen. You need to be able to move quickly. You need to have a small collection of items that keep you safe and keep you self-sustaining as possible. I feel like most people feel like they're playing a video game. They want to win. I felt like she was the most, like you said, grounded and in reality with us while also thinking about what potential skills she might need.
This is basically why I wanted to start the podcast with you, or like do this podcast with you in the first place, was that I just wanted to watch TV and then talk to you about it. So what a joy to just get to like open format, be like, here's what we're watching. And I'm so, so, so excited. I can't wait for season two to launch and to get to talk about all the things.
Me too. Yeah, I love this so much. Y'all are never going to know what we're watching.
Support Popaganda, please like, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. It really makes a difference.